Conservatives often complain that so-called activist judges use the courts to advance political agendas, disregarding the Constitution and the will of Congress. Our guest this hour, legal analyst Ian Millhiser, complains about activist judges too, but he says the real activists have been five generations of Supreme Court justices who, with a few exceptions, have favored the interests of the rich, white, and powerful over workers, women, children, voters, and people of color. Since the Civil War, Millhiser says, the court has trampled over constitutional amendments and legislation designed to help blacks protect women and children from inhuman working conditions and level America's economic playing field while siding with the wealthy and powerful. Ian Millhiser and a provocative new history of the Supreme Court on Midday after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Rodericks here. Our guest in this hour of the show is scheduled to be Ian Millhiser, author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And so far, we have not been able to connect with my guests, so I'm going to open the phone lines here for anyone who'd like to follow up on the conversation we had in the previous hour with Joe Dominic about policing in Baltimore, LAPD, since Rodney King. Some of you who called in weren't able to get on. If you want to call in, feel free to do that now, because I'm not sure how much time this will take to connect with our guest, Ian Millhiser. So I want to bring you his very provocative and interesting history of the Supreme Court. This is June, of course, the last month of the annual term of the Supreme Court. So yesterday there were some rulings. We expect more rulings this month on Mondays up until the end of the month. A couple of cases in particular, one on same-sex marriage rights and another one on the Affordable Care Act. Oh, do we have him?
I'm right here.
Ian, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm not so sure. Can you speak on the phone a little bit? Just give us your name, Ian Millhiser.
Oh, sure. So my name's Ian Millhiser, you know, here to discuss my book, Injustices.
Okay. Not crazy about the connection we have with you, Ian. Are you on a cell phone?
No, it's a landline.
Yeah, it's a little distorted. Let's put Ian on hold and try to call him back and see if we can get a better connection, because I don't want to spend the hour with a distorted phone line like that. So we'll try that again. In the meantime, I'll just move ahead and introduce this topic to you, and we won't have open phones after all, because Ian he's there. We'll try to connect with him. The Supreme Court. Yes, everybody likes to criticize the Supreme Court of the United States, but Ian Millhiser, who you just heard from and hopefully we'll hear from again, would likely argue that the court actually has a far better reputation than it deserves. Often viewed as the last refuge for the oppressed and powerless, Ian Millhiser argues that since the Civil War, few American institutions have inflicted greater suffering on ordinary people than the Supreme Court of the United States. With a few exceptions, Ian says five generations of activist justices have assumed vast powers that are never mentioned in the Constitution, and they have used those powers to advance the interests of the rich, white, and powerful. Just how that played out is the subject of this book I have been eager to talk about on the show today, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. The book indicts the Supreme Court for shaping a nation where children were forced to toil in coal mines and women labored in factories under the most brutal conditions, where efforts by Congress and state legislatures to set minimum wages were routinely overturned by the court, where the voting rights of black Americans could be nullified by southern state legislatures, where loyal Americans could be forced into detention camps because of their race, and where a woman could be sterilized against her will by state law. The court, Ian writes, was, quote, the midwife of Jim Crow, the right hand of union busters, and the dead hand of the conspiracy, of the Confederacy, excuse me. When it did make a stand, it was only after public opinion had moved beyond it already. The civil rights victories of the Warren Court were a brief aberration, he writes. Today's conservative majority is back in tune with its forebears, attacking the Voting Rights Act and granting billionaires great influence over the political process. Ian Millhiser says the court's treatment of big business has become so one-sided that the side championed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce wins 70% of the time. That compares to 43%, a 43% win rate under Chief Justice Warren Berger, a Republican Nixon appointee. Soon, the court will rule, as I said, on those issues of gay marriage, one instance where it has sided with a minority, actually, as well as determine whether millions of Americans will lose affordable insurance under the Affordable Care Act. That's coming up this month. How will they vote? We'll ask Ian Millhiser, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, editor of its Justice blog, and a frequent contributor on legal issues to newspapers and magazines and a variety of broadcast media. The book, again, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. It's published by Nation Books. So, Ian, are you there with us?
I am.
Okay. It's still not a great phone line, but let's go on here. Let's see what we can do. Okay? It is live radio.
All right, let's do it.
Let me see. I wanted to start with this thought. After reading your book and the notes that my producer provided on the book, in recent years, 2010, Citizens United, I think it was last year, Hobby Lobby, corporations are people. A lot of Americans are scratching their head over this idea that a corporation could have the same standing as an individual when it comes to civil liberties and rights. But when you look back at the history that you describe, that's not so unusual for the Supreme Court.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, as you were introducing me, you hit some of the greatest hits or the least great hits of the Supreme Court's history. This is an institution that struck down child labor laws. This is an institution that didn't just uphold segregation. This is the institution that may have done as much to usher in Jim Crow as anyone else, by throwing out the convictions of a white mob that massacred African-Americans who were seeking their right to vote. As you mentioned more recently, it's the Supreme Court that gave us Citizens United. This is the Supreme Court that this term could take health care away from 8 million people. And as I discuss in the book, even during the times when the Supreme Court has done good things, often the good things that is done have not been as effective as we tend to think they are, including Brown v. Board of Education. So I think that the long arc of the Supreme Court's history has been very negative, and it's an institution that has done a great deal of harm in American history.
All right, we're going to go back over that history. We'll go back to the Civil War. Before I do, though, I'm just eager to ask you about the Burwell case. That's mm-hmm. the case that where, what is it, four words in the Affordable Care Act are being presented to the Supreme Court in a challenge brought by conservatives who oppose the Affordable Care Act, suggesting that states that did not set up their own health care exchanges, as Maryland did, may not be eligible for the federal subsidies
right.
that people need in order to afford the insurance. Are you surprised that they even took that case?
I was very surprised that they took this case. I mean, the issue in this case is whether or not nine justices, all of whom have Ivy League law degrees, by the way, are capable of reading more than one sentence. There is one sentence of the law. It refers to an exchange established by the state. And if you read that sentence completely out of context, it seems to suggest, as you said, that in as many as 37 states where the federal government and not the state government runs the exchange where people can buy health care, subsidies are not available. If you take those subsidies away, an estimated 8 million people won't be able to afford their health insurance anymore. The trouble with their legal theory is that the Affordable Care Act is actually a lot longer than one sentence. The word exchange is defined in the law. It's defined to say that any exchange, whether state or federal, shall be deemed to be an exchange established by the state. There are various provisions of the law that are just absurd. They make no sense if you read that one, if you read it the way that the plaintiffs want it to be read. So, again, this is a lawsuit about whether or not nine people with Ivy League law degrees are capable of reading more than one sentence. And the fact that they're even considering this case suggests to me that, you know, I don't want to suggest bad faith on their part, but certainly, you know, psychologists talk a lot about motivated reasoning, the phenomenon where people want something to be true, so they convince it that they're they convince themselves that they're true. And it's possible that the five justices on the Supreme Court will manage to convince themselves that you don't have to read the whole law, you only have to read these few words out of context.
Ian, do you think you were objective in your approach to this book and this history?
I hope I was accurate in my approach. I strive to be correct in what I have to say. Whenever you express a strong viewpoint, I think people accuse you of bias. And my response to that is, show me where I was wrong. The Supreme Court did strike down child labor laws. The Supreme Court did stand on the side of Jim Crow. The Supreme Court did say that we can have all of this money in our elections. The Supreme Court did make it nearly impossible to unionize for many, many years. And the Supreme Court did take this case we were just discussing that could not just lead to so many people losing their health care, but could lead to, you know, an estimated 10,000 people dying every year who otherwise should have lived. So my concern is that I'm correct in my assessment of the court. And when I look at the history, I sadly think that what I have to say about the court is right.
Okay, Ian, now we'll step back in time for a bit of a history lesson here and understanding of the Constitution, which we need in order to go forward with your history here. So let's go back to the Civil War. Let's talk about the 14th Amendment. Refresher for those who need that.
Sure thing. So the 14th Amendment was one of the three amendments enacted in the wake of the Civil War. It's probably the most important of the three post-Civil War amendments because it goes beyond just giving a specific right to groups. It goes beyond, say, eliminating slavery. And it's supposed to say that we cannot have a system of apartheid in this country, period. You know, we cannot have a situation where people on the basis of some irrational classification are treated differently than others. It also fundamentally changed the nature of our democracy. You know, before the 14th Amendment, things like the Bill of Rights were understood to only apply to the federal government. The idea was that rights weren't necessarily conceived as the way that we think of them now as human rights, where there are certain things that government can't do to you or that anyone can't do to you because you're a human being and you have that right. It was a question of which government has the power to do what to you, the state or the federal government. And the 14th Amendment was supposed to change that and say that there are certain rights that we have simply because we are human beings. Now, as I explain in the book, you know, the 14th Amendment did a lot of wonderful things, but it was flawed in that it is an incredibly vague amendment. You know, it refers to how no one shall be denied the privileges or immunities of citizenship, but doesn't tell you what the privileges or immunities of citizenship are. It says that no one shall be denied liberty without due process, but doesn't tell you what liberty is. And what has happened time and time again throughout the Supreme Court's history is the Supreme Court has taken vague phrases of the Constitution, and frequently was vague phrases of the 14th Amendment, and have breathed their policy preferences into it. So at one point, for example, the Supreme Court said we couldn't have a minimum wage. And why was that? Because there was a majority of the Supreme Court who said that if you have to pay someone a minimum wage or if you can't be paid less than the minimum wage, that takes away your liberty. You know, that's not how I would understand liberty. But again, when you have this very vague word, it delegated a lot of power to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court often used that power quite unwisely.
You mean it deprived liberty of the employer who would have to pay a minimum wage?
Well, both, actually. I mean, that was part of what was so insane about the decisions of that era, is that the logic was that if I am a worker and I want to work for peanuts, I should have the liberty to work for peanuts. And of course, the problem with that rationale is that it completely ignores how workplace negotiations actually work. It ignores the fact that, you know, the employer generally has more negotiating power than the employee, especially when we're talking about a working class employee. Mm-hmm. The seminal case, you know, to give you a sense of how little bargaining power employers had in this era was a case called Lochner, which involved bakers in the state of New York. bakeries were cesspools in this era. You know, the workers would work, sometimes they worked 24-hour shifts. They work as many as 100 hours a week. They would sleep on the tables where they needed the dough. I have some very graphic descriptions of the book that I don't know that you'd want me to repeat on the radio of the health conditions in these bakeries, but there were walls covered in roaches in some of these bakeries. There was standing water. In some cases, the workers didn't have floors to stand on. They just stood on mud. So they did not have the negotiating power to live in humane working conditions, much less to get paid a decent wage. And yet the Supreme Court said that, oh, we would be taking away your liberty, the government would be taking away your liberty if we didn't allow you to negotiate for a contract where you have to work absurdly long hours in those squalid work conditions.
We're going to take a break here, Ian. Thank you again for being with us today. Ian Millhiser, his book is Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. When we get back, how much of Lincoln's decision to free black slaves was undone by the Supreme Court in the years after the Civil War. A chapter of this book called How the Civil War Was Undone. We'll talk about that when we get back here on the Midday Show. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Ian Millhiser, a lawyer and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a liberal Washington think tank. And Ian has written a provocative indictment of the Supreme Court as an institution, claiming that since the Civil War, it has almost always favored the rich, white, and powerful over the poor, black, young, and powerless. His new book is called Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. So if you were keeping a scorecard over that 150 years since we just reached the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, you would say, except for maybe the Earl Warren years in the Supreme Court, most of the Supreme Court's history is, as you say here, Ian, favoring the powerful moneyed interests over poor Americans, minorities, women, children.
I would certainly say that for most of its history, that's how the Supreme Court has looked. But I think I should make a second point, which is more importantly, the Supreme Court has favored the rich and has favored the powerful at the expense of the law. It's one thing, you know, if Congress passes a law and that law is good for rich people, judges have to follow it unless it's unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. You know, if the Constitution says something and it turns out that very powerful individuals benefit from what the Constitution says, the Supreme Court has to follow it. The problem is not simply that the Supreme Court was doing things that, like, I object to on moral grounds. It's that they were doing things that are objectionable on legal grounds. For example, the Constitution says that Congress can regulate interstate commerce. That was interpreted very early in American history to mean any commerce that involves more states than one. But when Congress tried to ban the transit of goods that were produced by children, it was an attempt to prevent child labor, the Supreme Court said, oh, no, I know it says commerce, but we're not going to count that. The Constitution, to go back to the 14th Amendment, is very explicit that we're not going to have discrimination of a certain kind in this country. And, of course, the 14th Amendment was built in the, was ratified in the context of the end of the Civil War and a desire to eliminate racial apartheid. And yet for many, many years, the Supreme Court, went much further than just standing with segregation. I mean, they really stepped back and let an entire Jim Crow system build despite what the Constitution has to say. So my beef with the Supreme Court is, not just that, I don't like the results of what they're doing. If I don't like the results, but the Constitution said something, I'm stuck with it. The problem is that they can't follow the written legal text that they're supposed to be bound by.
So it's not just a matter of the Supreme Court making an attempt to clean up language in statutes passed by Congress. You say that they actually have ruled counter to what the law says.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can pick those examples throughout American history.
Well, you gave us a good one there with the children. I mean, the description in your book of kids working in coal mines you know, cleaning up coal, basically pulling out what is it called, slag or slate or whatever,
slate
that gets mixed in with coal. Children being smothered by collapses in the mines, and 8 years old, 9, 10 year old children. So, in the progressive era, early in the 20th century, Congress passed this law about, you know, we will not interstate commerce. Excuse me, you said it better than I did. Coal cannot pass from one state to another. Right?
Right.
That's been harvested in any way by children under the age of whatever it was then.
Right.
Yeah. But the Supreme Court said, no, that's not what was intended by the law.
Right. So, I mean, it's an interesting case both legally and, I mean, you know, while the facts are horrific, you know, I think the facts are fascinating. You know, in the coal industry in the early 20th century, children as young as 6 would begin work working in what are called as breakers. And breakers were these wedge-shaped buildings. They were shaped that way to create a slope. And a river of coal would flow down the center of buildings. And children would sit on beams suspended over this river of coal. And their job was to reach down and pick things out that was not coal, mostly slate, from the river of coal so that the product that was delivered to the customers would be pure. What wound up happening is that children would sometimes have their fingers crushed when they reached down, and it was, you know, a big piece of coal would slam them. There were chutes that the children were supposed to throw the coal down, and they would frequently fall into these chutes. And if the fall didn't kill them, they would then be suffocated by the coal that would be and the slate that would be poured in on top of them. They were whipped if they did not work hard enough, and they were paid a few pennies a day for this. And similar conditions existed in cotton mills, similar conditions existed in shrimperies. I mean, this was a very common practice. The Supreme Court struck down the federal law saying that we couldn't have child labor. And what's interesting about the legal history here, so the court in a decision in the late 19th century that I think was also wrong, said that the Constitution says we can regulate commerce. Commerce only means the transport of goods. It doesn't mean the manufacture of goods. And so that was a limit the Supreme Court had already placed. So the Congress said, okay, we'll operate within that limit. We will ban the transit of goods, produced by children. That was something that the Supreme Court had already said that Congress could do. The Congress had passed laws banning the transit of lottery tickets, banning the transit of alcohol, banning the transit of prostitutes, and the Congress had said that was okay. But once it came to child labor, the Supreme Court changed the rules. So you had this pattern of the Supreme Court not just ignoring the law, but ignoring the law once, Congress finds a way around it, and then the Supreme Court said, oh, that thing that we said 20 years ago, just kidding, we actually meant this other thing that's even more restrictive of your ability to regulate the workplace.
Back to the 14th Amendment and due process? Is that how they rationalized it?
So in the 14th Amendment context, so the way that they rationalized the child labor decision is they claimed that Congress had acted beyond its power to regulate commerce.
Oh, okay.
But there was all kinds of nasty stuff done in the 14th Amendment context. So, like I said, the 14th Amendment has this very very vague phrase that no one shall be denied liberty without due process of law. And so when the Supreme Court didn't like a law, they just say, well, you have a liberty there.
Right.
You have a liberty to not have a law forcing you to be overworked.
Wow.
Yeah, you have a liberty not to have a minimum wage law.
That came in handy in all kinds of cases. I want to mention this to you, Ian, and to our listeners. Most people in the audience can list Supreme Court justices, if not chief justices, through history. Oliver Wendell Holmes, John Marshall, Roger Taney, who's right from good old Roger Taney from here in Maryland. Earl Warren, go way back to John Jay, Warren Burger. Who else? I can mention Charles Evan Hughes, Felix Frankfurter. But the name Stephen Johnson Field, somehow I missed this one.
Yep.
But it was a very important figure in the context of what you're writing about in your book.
Yeah, no, Field is probably the villain of my story. Field is very important for two reasons. The first is that he had a uniquely libertarian outlook where he was very, very hostile to business regulations, very, very hostile to taxation of the wealthy. But the other thing that makes him significant is when he got on the court. So he was a Lincoln appointee to the court. And one thing that happened during the Lincoln presidency is we finished the Transcontinental Railroad. Before the Transcontinental Railroad, took about 120 days to go from New York to California. You had to sail a ship around the bottom of South America. Alternatively, you could try going through Panama, but if you did that, you'd probably die of a tropical disease. So right. if you were smart, you took this long 4-month-long trip around the tip of South America and then back up again. After we had the Transcontinental Railroad, it took 6 days to go from New York to L.A. And that completely transformed the United States. You know, all of a sudden, it was possible to have commerce in a way we never had it before. You know, before the railroads, if you were in New York, your customers were in New York. After the railroads, it was possible for a New York company to compete with an Illinois company, to compete with a Virginia company, to compete with a Florida company. And that meant that we had, you know, a great deal of economic growth. It also meant that we had corporations formed that were wealthier and more powerful than any king had ever been. And that created a demand amongst the powerful people at the head of these corporations to protect them from the regulation that was necessary in order to regulate this new economic world we were living in. Field was essentially their man inside the Supreme Court. Field was the guy who championed the notion that the Constitution, you know, based on no actual language in the Constitution, is very skeptical of business regulation, is very skeptical of attempts to regulate or, you know, to tax the rich, to change how the rich live their lives. And while he did not live to see a lot of his philosophy of how the Constitution's work implemented, he died before the Lochner decision that I mentioned earlier. But his ideas became the basis for these decisions I was talking about earlier, which said that we couldn't have things like a minimum wage, which said that we couldn't have things like maximum hour laws, like protections for unions.
And that lived on for decades after he departed.
It did. I mean, really, what broke the back of that era was the Great Depression, because, you know, up until the Great Depression, we had never tried to have a meaningful regulatory and welfare state, and when we had tried it, the Supreme Court had struck it down. But, you know, things were fairly prosperous in the Coolidge administration. And so I think that it was hard to build the groundswell of support for doing things a different way. After the Great Depression happened and President Roosevelt was doing everything he could imagine to try to lift the nation out of this terrible poverty, and the Supreme Court frequently was striking it down, I think that caused the nation to have, you know, it was an eye-opening moment where we realized, wait a second. We're not doing something right here. We need to be able to fight this depression. And I'll say one other thing to, you know, my libertarian friends who tend to tend to look back fondly on the way that things were before the Roosevelt era. They would have a point if America hadn't prospered so much after the Roosevelt presidency. In the years since we changed our way of doing things, in the years since the Supreme Court took the brakes off the government and took the brakes off the economy, the United States has become the wealthiest nation in the history of money and the most powerful nation in the history of power. And so, you know, I question the notion that we would want to go back to the way things were when the way things that we are doing things now seems to have worked pretty well.
Ian Millhiser is our guest on Midday. His book is Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. We'll step back in time again, back to the Civil War era, Ian, to talk about this chapter called How the Civil War Was Undone. You argue that the court essentially did everything it possibly could to reverse or undermine Lincoln's decision to free the slaves, and all the freedoms that Congress wanted to grant them, the protections they wanted to grant them after the Civil War into the 1870s and 1880s.
No, so I mean, there's a bit of nuance to that era, but ultimately the Supreme Court, I think, handled the challenges of the post-Civil War era very, very poorly. You know, one of the other big villains in my book is a man named John Archibald Campbell. Campbell was a former Supreme Court justice. He was appointed before the Civil War, and he left the court to become the Assistant Secretary of War in the Confederacy. So he was the number two person in the War Department in the Confederacy. And then after the South lost the war, he became bitter. He moved to New Orleans, and he started a law practice that was basically a white supremacist law practice. You know, the point of this law practice was to sue in order to undermine Reconstruction and in order to undermine laws that were intended to welcome black people into the American contract. And, you know, his first effort didn't go so well. But one of his later efforts was this case called Cruikshank. Cruikshank involved a literal massacre. There was a disputed election where the black Republicans claimed that they won. Because they believed they had the right to control this local parish government, they occupied the local courthouse, which was the center of the government. And a white supremacist mob led by a former Confederate officer marched upon the courthouse and massacred them. I mean, dozens of African Americans were slaughtered simply because they were trying to exercise, you know, they had exercised their right to vote now that they thought that what they had voted for should matter.
This is in Louisiana, right?
Ian? This is in Louisiana, yeah.
1873, I have it. Is.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, Colfax, Louisiana. So a white the Department of Justice performed a superhuman task. They convinced a mostly white jury to convict several members of this mob for violating the civil rights of the people that they killed. And the Supreme Court threw out those convictions. And they didn't just throw out those convictions. What they said was they said that African Americans in the South must look to the states to vindicate their constitutional rights or to vindicate certain constitutional rights. Now, just think about that for a second. You know, we're talking about an era where Reconstruction was beginning to crumble, where white supremacists were slowly recapturing Southern governments. And at the very moment where, you know, the Klan was starting to become a thing, at the very moment when white supremacist governments, often backed by violent militia groups, were beginning to capture Southern governments, the Supreme Court said, if you are black and you feel that your constitutional rights are being violated, your recourse is to the white supremacist government of your state. And that, you know, possibly more than anything, laid the groundwork for Jim Crow.
Were they applying the 14th Amendment there again?
It's a very bizarre decision. Technically the basis for the decision was that the prosecutor had messed up when they filed one of the papers that they had to file at the trial stage. And so that was the narrow basis for the decision. But they then included all of this superfluous language about whether or not the people who were slaughtered in this case would have had recourse to various constitutional provisions. And over again, they said, nope, you don't have recourse to the First Amendment. Nope, you don't have recourse to the Second Amendment, and so on and so forth. And that was where the court made the statement that these individuals had to look to the states to vindicate their rights. Hmm.
So, Ian Millhiser, if someone says to you, why did we need the Civil Rights Act of 1965, you raise the specter of Cruikshank.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, well, and not just Cruikshank, but like this is the dark side of Brown. I mean, I shouldn't say the dark side, but at least the ineffectual side of Brown v. Board of Education. So, you know, Brown was, you know, we all think of this as the turning point in American history, where the Supreme Court, having supported segregation and having done all these terrible things, decided it was time to atone, and it declared public school segregation unconstitutional. That was a very good thing. But for 10 years after Brown, only about 1% of black students in the South attended integrated schools. And there were a lot of reasons for that. I mean, one of those reasons was terrorism. You know, the Ku Klux Klan was a terrorist organization. And if a black student tried to attend an historically white school, the Ku Klux Klan would often just kill that student. So I think that Brown showed the limits of the effectiveness of the Supreme Court, even when it was trying to do good. What eventually broke the back of Jim Crow wasn't Brown. What eventually broke the back of Jim Crow was the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which did a lot of things. Two of the things that it did was it allowed states to sue directly, or rather it allowed the federal government to sue directly when a state had segregated schools. So the NAACP, which was really the only group that was litigating these cases at this point, no longer had to find a black family that was willing to risk Klan violence in order to bring a lawsuit. And then the second thing that happened was that the federal government gained the power to take funding away from state school systems that were segregated. And once the Congress got involved, once the full force of the federal government got involved, that's what started to dismantle Jim Crow. It took an act of Congress. Not, you know, the court alone wasn't able to make very much progress in that space.
I misspoke. I said Civil Rights Act of 65. I meant 64. The Voting Rights Act of 65. And I meant it also because of when you're talking about murder and lynchings that followed Cruikshank, you know, the feds, this, under the Civil Rights Act, the feds got jurisdiction over anything racially motivated in terms of murder or lynchings, right?
Yeah, I mean there was a bunch of civil rights legislation that has expanded the role of the federal that has expanded the role of the federal government. There's also, you know, a lot of civil rights legislation that existed since the Civil War, which the federal government started enforcing more rigorously in that era. One thing that I think a lot of people don't realize about the civil rights era is, you know, the part of how Nixon got elected was he attacked the Supreme Court for its criminal justice decisions. And, you know, the Supreme Court was, you know, they breathed new life into the Fourth Amendment so that there were suddenly more real limits on unlawful searches and seizures. They breathed limit into the requirement that people have to have an attorney, saying that, you know, the government will actually pay for people to have an attorney. Although, you know, that's only been met with mixed success in recent history. You know, they breathed real life into the Miranda requirement. You know, the Supreme Court said that you don't just have these rights, you have to be told of these rights. And Nixon railed against these rights. But the reason why the Supreme Court was so insistent on protecting this, besides the fact that there's criminal justice protections actually in the Constitution, is because they understood that the project of racial justice could not succeed without criminal justice. You know, I mean, this is something that I know the folks in Baltimore are intimately aware of.
Yeah.
You know, in the South during the Jim Crow era, you had kangaroo courts where for a while there were lynchings. Lynchings actually went way down in the early part of the 20th century. But the reason why the number of lynchings went down in the 20th century is because the state governments became complicit in the lynching. So you know, a lynching is what happens when it is an extrajudicial killing. What happened often in the early part of the 20th century is that a black man would be arrested, often for a crime they did not commit. The state would run the person through a kangaroo trial. Often there were state laws saying that that the whole trial had to be from accusation to conviction in 10 days. And at the end of the trial, when the jury convicted the person and the person was sentenced to death, the judge would thank the jury and would thank the town for not lynching the person yet so that they could have this nice show, this nice show of civilization.
Yeah, amazing. Ian, we got to take another break here. That's a good spot to do it. Something to think about. Ian Millhiser. Shake your head at these things, these stories, but they're from American history. Ian Millhiser, Injustices, his book, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, here on the Midday Show. More with Ian when we get right back. Welcome back to Midday. Ian Millhiser with us, a lawyer, writer, and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, with his new book, Injustices, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And with some of the stories that you've recounted here for us, Ian, and the points you make about the court and the law over the years, especially in the 19th century, you know, someone listening to this could say, okay, well, he's talking about ancient history. You know, he's talking about Reconstruction era, early 20th century. Certainly things got better during the New Deal and Roosevelt, and that ushered in the Warren Court, and we've had a lot of progress since then. So the Supreme Court has really, you know, come up to speed.
Well, so, you know, unless you look at the last 10 years or so, yeah, you know, I mean, let's talk about the Voting Rights Act.
Okay.
You know, the Voting Rights Act may be the single most successful prong of the American civil rights pantheon. You know, before the Civil Rights Act, African Americans in Mississippi, I believe it was something like 7% of African Americans in Mississippi were registered. And within years, that number, I believe the figure is that it sextupled. I mean, it is absurd how fast voter registration moved up and voting moved up amongst African Americans because of the Voting Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why the Voting Rights Act was successful is that it recognized the limitations of the courts. What happened in the Jim Crow era is people who didn't want black people to vote were very, very agile. So, you know, a state would say that there was a poll test, and a court would strike down the poll test. So they'd say, okay, well, now we're going to have a different poll test. And the court would say, well, you can't have any poll test. So then they'd say, okay, well, we're going to make sure that the election really happens in the primary, and only white people allowed to vote in the primary. And eventually the court said, you can't do that. So they said, okay, we're going to have a poll tax. And eventually the court said, you can't do that. I mean, the thing that happened was that the people who didn't want African Americans to vote were just so nimble. You know, in some cases, they would literally move the polling place or move the voter registration place and only tell the white people where they had moved it to. So, like, you know, they were quicker than the courts were. And what the Voting Rights Act did is it said that in states and in areas where there was a long history of voter suppression, any new voting practice, doesn't matter whether it has something to do with race or not, has to first be reviewed by federal officials in Washington to make sure it doesn't engage in race discrimination. And once it's past that gate, then it's allowed to go into effect and everything is fine. But the idea was to stop these practices from going into effect before they started, so that the nimbleness of vote suppressors wouldn't be a problem. And then the Supreme Court struck that provision down. They struck that provision down very recently in a case called Shelby County. Justice Ginsburg wrote a wonderful dissent where she responded to the majority opinion's claim that, well, things have gotten better in the South, so we don't need this anymore, by saying, it's like saying that I'm no longer getting wet, so I'm going to put away my umbrella. You know, the whole reason why things got better was because of the Voting Rights Act. And literally within 2 hours of the voting of this provision of the Voting Rights Act being struck down, Texas announced that it was going to implement a voter suppression law that had been put on hold. Within a few months, North Carolina enacted the most comprehensive voter suppression law that I believe any state has. They basically cobbled together all the bad ideas. Let's reduce early voting here. Let's impose a voter ID law there. Let's do this other thing here. They cobbled together all of these ideas and put them together into one omnibus, let's make it harder to vote law. And that never would have flown if it wasn't for what the Supreme Court did by striking down the Voting Rights Act.
But Chief Justice Roberts says he's the umpire, right? He just calls the balls and strikes.
I mean, I don't necessarily disbelieve him. I mean, that's the thing that makes the Supreme Court so scary, is like, it would be one thing if they were just liars. You know, because if they're liars, at least you can catch them in a lie. What scares me so much, I mean, I used this term earlier, motivated reasoning, where people have this remarkable talent for convincing themselves that the thing that they want to be true is true. You know, I mean, I don't necessarily even think that John Roberts is a bad person. I mean, I think that he wants to believe this very pleasant narrative that, you know, I was taught in middle school and that makes us all feel very good, that racism is a thing that existed before the 1960s, and then Martin Luther King happened and now it's gone. And, you know, that's a very pleasant thing to believe, but it doesn't have the virtue of being true.
How does the court maintain its credibility, if it does? I don't even know what the court's standing is in public opinion polls anymore. I had the pleasure of a conversation on this show with Justice Breyer a few years ago, and we talked about that a lot. And he seemed confident that, you know, over time, history, people maintain their confidence in the court.
Yeah, I mean, what the polls do show that it's losing support. And I think a big reason why the court is losing support is because it's being viewed as more and more a place where partisans go to get the things that they should be trying to get through the legitimate political process.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, it's losing support on both sides. I mean, it's even as the court does more and more things that are the sort of things you would expect Republicans to like. You know, it's actually, you know, rapidly losing support amongst Republicans. You know, some of that, I think, is because they don't like the fact that the court didn't buy this case trying to kill the Affordable Care Act. I can get into why that case was ridiculous. But I think a lot of it is just that when the court opens itself up, you know, when it puts it out there as someone that's going to dole as an institution that's going to dole out political favors, then people get mad when they feel like they haven't got enough favors. You know, the way that the court protects its institutional legitimacy is by being able to say, you know, with its head erect and with confidence and with credibility that it is just following the law. You know, the law says a ton of things that I do not like. And I read all kinds of judicial opinions that reach results that I hate. But I recognize the legitimacy of the opinion because I can see, okay, this judge did something that they had to do because that's what the law says. But I think that when the court starts to hold itself, you know, when it starts to do things like contemplate this case that's in front of it right now that could take health care away from so many people based on the notion that only one sentence of the law counts and the rest of it doesn't, you know, when it starts to countenance things like that, I don't think you should be surprised that people are saying, oh, well, you know, if this is an organization that doles out political favors, I should get mine.
Yeah, that's my trouble with the Burwell case. I mean, we had an important ruling from the court, in 2012, right?
That's right.
2012 term. And, you know, they threw away the Medicaid mandate for the states, but they upheld the ACA and was a surprise vote from the Chief Justice. And here we are in 2015 looking at four words from the statute.
Right. And then let me tell you, I mean, this was really the inspiration for me to write the book. I mean,
This case, the Burwell case?
Or the NFIB case, the first attack on the Affordable Care Act. You know, I worked very, very hard on that case. I wrote a number of briefs in that case. And, you know, before we had the Affordable Care Act, people were told that if they were raped, it was a pre-existing condition. You know, you had 45,000 Americans die every year because they didn't have health care. The idea the Supreme Court wanted to take us back to that world should wound your soul.
Ian Millhiser with us in this hour of the show. Thank you. I'm glad we were able to get you on the show with us today, Ian. And congratulations on the book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Ian is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the editor of Think Progress Justice. This book is published by Nation Books. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yep, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. I hope you have an enjoyable afternoon. We'll come back again for our show tomorrow, 12 to 2 here on WYPR.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Aaliyah Satterfield, Kaylee Sodick, and Campbell Reed. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.